Okay, boom. Now we are moving to the regular.
Hey, Chair Kachisha needs a second to.
Oh, okay.
Get you cycled over.
To cycle over to the recording.
Thanks.
Okay. The regular session is now commenced. First item is the call to order and the roll call. So, Mr. Bob Berman.
Here.
Jim Hanselman.
Here.
Braulio Escobar.
Here.
Marjorie Blom.
Here.
John Updike.
Here.
Bill Brannigan, here. Gary East has been excused. Next on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. I reviewed the minutes and sent the very, very, very minor corrections out to everybody in Surrey, so.
Well, knowing that Chair Brannigan has thoroughly reviewed the minutes and submitted minor corrections, I move that we approve the work session minutes of April 24th and the regular session minutes of 8:24 as amended.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Okay, next up is citizens' public comment. We had one person.
Nah, he doesn't count.
No.
He's not a citizen.
No, Greg was back there from the tap house, but he left. Do we have anybody else on the, other than John Updike?
That is all.
That's all, okay. I guess I can dispense with the.
No public hearing.
With the, yeah. So, I guess next up is the action items, since there's nobody here, do I need to read out the legislative land use public?
That's not a hearing, you're good.
Okay.
Just three action items tonight.
Okay, so we're into action items. The first item up is file number 2-CUP-23, the final order and findings for the South Beach Church conditional use permit. Staff for comments?
I'll just move we approve.
Yeah.
The final order and findings for the South Beach Church conditional use permit, file 2-CUP-23.
I'll second it.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any negatives? Hearing none, motion approved.
You can leave.
Congratulations, Dustin.
Congratulations, Dustin.
Go count the cars.
We didn't even have to have the applicant's testimony this time.
I had testimony to give to them too. Did you share that email with them by any chance?
Which
email I wrote you the night after the hearing?
Oh, no, you feel free to share it with them at this point.
Can I read that? Is that okay? Is that appropriate?
No, that's fine. It would have been inappropriate up to this point.
Okay.
That's okay.
All right. I'm just going to read the email because the public testimony had closed and I was like, oh man, like, right. I don't have a chance to say anything.
It was closed.
So the morning at 5 a.m. the next morning, I wrote Derek this email. I said, we appreciate all of your assistance with the South Beach Church conditional use permit application. Are very pleased the Planning Commission voted to unanimously approve the application last evening. I did want to provide some clarification regarding a discussion regarding Team Wilson Media that occurred after the public testimony and the applicant testimony period had closed. As you know, early in the process, we knew it would be a key part to the project to engage an acoustic consultant for the project. Pastor Luke reached out to his contacts and was referred to Team Wilson Media through a contact at Crossroads Church in Washington State. Nick Canfield and Brian Engel of Team Wilson Media, at the request of our team and Pastor Luke, reviewed the building design and provided their expert acoustic recommendations. Team Wilson Media has a specific focus on providing audio-visual design in addition to their other offered media services for churches across the country. I've CC'd both Nick and Brian on this email. Brian and Nick provided input on the layout of the facility, treatment considerations for the walls and surfaces, in addition to the acoustic system design per their memo that was submitted to the Planning Commission. Although we do rely on the expertise of acoustic consultants for this highly technical aspect of architecture, we did review their recommendations and they appear in general conformance with the best practices for large sanctuary acoustic treatments to control potential noise pollution. As our application demonstrated, we worked tirelessly to incorporate measures that would provide a wonderful experience for the church without negatively impacting the neighboring properties. Per the conditions of approval, Southview Church is committed to incorporating all the acoustic strategies outlined in the Team Wilson Media acoustic memo. Additionally, as Pastor Luke stated last evening, the church is committed to complying with all the City of Newport requirements in the future as the building is in operation. Please feel free to share this letter with the Planning Commission as a part of the official record. We're hopeful this will resolve any lingering questions that remain following last evening's meeting. Thanks, Dustin.
Thank you for the follow-up.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to talk desperately bad that night as I watched it unravel and wasn't able to speak, so. Okay. Yeah, thank you all.
Thank you, Dustin. Thank you.
Have a great evening.
Okay. Moving on, we have item number 4B, file number 1-CP-21, action on recommended housing production strategies. Derek.
Thank you. These are small. Try to bring them up.
Better than what was at the community meeting. I couldn't see.
That's got it, more or less. Here we go. Yes. All right, I'll pan through these in a second. So we had our in-person open house on the 25th of April. We had 50 people, about 49, I think, official count, who attended. So it was good on the in-person, you know, in addition to the 450.
Texting was cool.
Yeah, the instant polling. I mean, it had the only drawback on the instant polling is it had a top-end number that we weren't aware of, and we were hitting that, so not everybody could get their poll responses in. If they were late, it would hit the maximum. But on the flip side, the poll results, once you get a certain number of responses in, they start to take shape, and then, you know, it was pretty obvious, you know, those, you know, if they got a whole bunch of this high priority, a whole bunch of this is a low priority, a few more votes weren't going to really swing that. So we are now in a position where on the 15th, this is going to go before the City Council. They adopt the housing production strategy by resolution, not by ordinance. It doesn't go into our comprehensive plan. It doesn't go into our zoning code. It's a flexible document where it can be adjusted over time, you know, based on circumstances. So we have 13 right now housing production strategies. The feedback we had through the open houses was generally supportive of the strategies. It did influence the timing, and I'll touch on that on at least one of the strategies, because we had a lot of feedback that was a higher priority than we had plugged in terms of when we got to that issue. But I'll just run through them real quickly, and the opportunity really for you tonight is there any thoughts you want to share with the council? This is your opportunity to do that since we'll be presenting this to the council on the 15th. So we have 13 of these strategies identified. The first one is, leveraging our urban renewal funding to support housing and infrastructure development that will allow, housing development to move forward. This is for urban renewal right now. That's principally the Northside District and Agate Beach area, where there are opportunities for us to partner with property owners on getting the necessary infrastructure in place. And as part of that, leveraging through development agreements, guarantees that units are made available at certain price points if they're going to be owner occupied, or if they're going to be rentals on there, that those rentals hit within certain price points. That's all something that can be negotiated through development agreements. That's the concept here. Eventually, once the South Beach District closes, there's a recommendation in here for the city to pursue forming a new one or expanding Northside so that urban renewal resources can be used a little bit more aggressively with respect to housing. One other way urban renewal can be used is right now would be through strategic site acquisition. where the agency acquires the property to make it available for affordable housing. Again, north side, most of that housing opportunities are up in the Agate Beach area, although there are opportunities, for example, in the city center area as part of the redevelopment to see housing come in on other than street grade, you know, so you get apartments, second, third floor type apartments.
Could those, there be an effort to make those affordable also, or just to get more doors, as Dustin would say?
It depends on the project, but there's certainly an opportunity to get affordable housing as part of this in the truest context, that some percentage of the units be available at 60% or 8% median area income. But
the city center we're talking about.
Correct. But there probably, you know, you could see a project in the city center area, for example, where your upper floor with views of the ocean are held at market rate, and you do the affordable on your second and third floor, and then you have street grade, which is commercial. I mean, there are different ways for that to be packaged, depending on who the partners are and, you know, and how that, you know, what their objectives are too, because it wouldn't all be urban renewal. And if we're going to have it at affordable, we need somebody who's there who, like a housing authority or somebody who's actively managing it to ensure that affordability stays that way in an ongoing way. Implementing the home buyer opportunity limited tax exemption. This is basically a tax exemption for a 10-year period to help people transition into owner occupancy. You know, that, you know, they're barely able to get there, or they're not able to get there if not for, you know, a 10-year property tax exemption that keeps their mortgage payments down. You know, as I think, you know, if you're a homeowner, you know, the one big challenge is getting into the home. Once you're into the home, you know, you can get the ball rolling and, you know, and develop some equity, but it's getting into the home. And this particular tool can be used for that purpose.
What is 120% currently, you know?
Oh, this...
That's like a down payment assistance program, right?
No, it's a property tax exemption. Do you know roughly what
the median sales price?
330?
Yeah.
No, it's higher than that.
I'm thinking it's like 400 or
400. It's going to be in the fours somewhere. It's where that number would land. I don't think it's up into the fives. It's dropped down a bit since interest rates have been climbing up. So somewhere in the fours.
I'm just wondering how that home buyer thing would be. Is it tied to your loan when you go to the bank and say, well, I'm getting this tax exemption? Or do I not need to ask about that? It's okay.
You know, we haven't gotten that far because that's part of the implementation process in terms of how that's set up. But presumably, yeah, the tax exemption would need to be in place or authorized before they,
right.
You know,
you'd be part of your loan package.
Exactly. If that was material to your ability to qualify for that home.
How
the mechanics of that work, that would be part of the implementation
process.
That's
my former life coming out. Okay.
This hasn't been widely used yet,
but
it's available on the books, and it's something else that could help move the dial.
I'm sorry, did you get what the 120 of median was?
It's probably somewhere in the fours right now, 400,000 range, maybe 425. I mean, yeah, it's...
That would strike me as an unusual low-income home buyer, you know. Even a moderate income home buyer. What I just saw numbers in the paper, what income, household income you needed to afford a $400,000 house, and it was over $100,000.
Well, right now, I think one of the discussion points with B too has to do with just helping people in the moderate income range. You know, I mean, this is your nurses, you know, folks that we can't recruit out here because you can't get into housing.
Sure.
Police, fire, workforce.
But, yeah, your workforce. Because my suspicion is even with the help, you're not. I mean, if you're low income, I don't know how this is probably gonna be more moderate, given where we're at right now.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
No expert. Reducing development code barriers to housing development. There are several of them that we can look at. Parking's one of them. We just talked about that. The tweaking the maximum building height just to make sure that multifamily can get three full floors, it's important because those projects don't pencil out without it. But we also don't want it to go crazy. So it's what can we do on that to address that concern? So there are a few things we can take a look at on the development code barriers. We can shift how we allocate some of the construction excise tax dollars we're collecting for affordable housing so that more of it ends up in the flexible pool. We've been collecting now for 5 years, about $500,000. If we make this change, we'll free up about $70,000. So it's not earth-shattering additional money that gets into the flexible pool, but it's something.
Yeah, it is.
There are a number of different options that were identified for lobbying the legislature, principally to get more resources for infrastructure. That's a biggie. And anywhere from loosening up how local governments can utilize room tax to putting a ballot measure out there to allow real estate transfer tax if those funds are used for land banking, for example, so that you could get land and make it available for affordable housing. So there are a number of areas dealing with disincentivizing second homes through the tax structure so you don't get a tax write-off for a second house. You know, things you can do at the state level to help move the dial that we can't do locally, you know. Establishing a low barrier emergency shelter and warming center, that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Going back to the lobbying.
Yeah.
Who takes the lead on that? Does the city council hire a lobbyist or?
No, that's a good question, Bob. The city actually does have a lobbyist for the council works through for the dam, for the new reservoir. We do have one at the federal level. And we do actually have a lobbyist, come to think of it, at the state level, too, on that matter. So that's one option. Cities do have lobbyists that they hire. If they're a large enough city, they have their own people that serve in that capacity.
But is that mostly League of Cities?
Or you use the League of Oregon Cities, or you directly engage, you know, with your representatives, Gomberg and Anderson, for example. Our council directly engages with them. You know, provide written testimony. There's a number of different ways. Through the league, it's usually a collaborative. So, I mean, if you're working through the league, whatever you're looking for needs to be something that the league can support generally for a broad range of communities. Whereas, you know, if you've got your own lobbyists, you can look for very specific things that help Newport, that are Newport specific.
Okay, thank you.
Establishing a low barrier emergency shelter and warming center, pretty high priority. One thing I would say, you know, we've on the warming center side of it, I think a number of you are aware that city council for a few years now, since the fairgrounds was no longer available for warming center use, has been providing Grace Winds $30,000-$40,000 a year for the so hotel voucher program that they run, and then the county has been providing funds too, but it's not an ideal circumstance. And one of the things we do have, the Episcopal Church is looking at trying to rally the faith-based community into kind of a rotating warming shelter concept. If they can get, I think probably at least four, if not more, churches on board, because they need enough so that, you know, Church A, you know, deals with warming, you know, with a certain weather event, and then the next, you know, next one up would be the other church, another church. And so you don't have the same group of volunteers that frankly get tapped out and stop doing it. It's a pretty good model. So a number of jurisdictions, Corvallis did that for a while. I'm not sure if it's still active there or not. But if you can get that kind of rotating warming shelter concept going amongst the faith-based community, it's a more reasonable ask of volunteers within a church.
Has the city ever thought about the rec center as a warming shelter?
It has been discussed, but not done. And I think principally because of other uses. and the logistics of trying to clear folks out for the other uses the rec center is intended for, so they've never gone down that path. Support development of a regional housing entity that focuses more on kind of the, frankly, more into that moderate income out of the safety net voucher type. You know, Housing Authority right now is really focused on 60% median area income or lower. So, I mean, expanding that up into the middle income range. A lot of particularly communities that are in areas where you have very high real estate prices, very attractive for tourism purposes, you have to have a housing entity that really deals with your moderate income housing, because you just don't even have that anymore. Continuing to participate in the Regional Homelessness Action Plan. Paying system development charges for workforce housing out of other pots. Part of that would be the using construction excise tax dollars for that. Sometimes we can use urban renewal funds for that purpose. Continuing partnerships and growing our partnerships with land trusts. We have a Dev Northwest and Proud Ground, both who we partner with currently and can expand upon those relationships. Honestly, I would put the Habitat for Humanity in this category as well, because they are also, you know, a good partner in this regard. Supporting outreach and education strategically to promote equitable housing access, getting an urban growth management agreement in place with the county, helpful to a point, but not one of the higher priorities. And then this is one, the last one, we moved up because of just the amount of public input on how important that is looking at rental housing maintenance code feasibility. So some, you know, stepping into the arena where we're ensuring the existing rental housing is in a condition that's habitable, suitable.
Well, that challenge. That could have a negative rather than a positive effect.
It could. You know, this is researching feasibility. What would be involved in standing up a program? What kind of resources would the city have to bring to bear to do it? That's typically or often handled by building offices, because our building official inspectors are the ones who are in a position to flag whether or not there are problems with faulty wiring or plumbing, or identify issues with, you know, problematic windows or leaking roofs and, you know, mold, those types of things. We moved up the feasibility analysis on the implementation based on the community feedback on that front. Now, whether or not the council at the end of the day is going to be saying, yeah, let's do it, is a whole different question. But, you know, we can, by 2024, pull together, okay, this is what it's involved in trying to stand up this type of program in a community of our size. This is what we need to be looking at in terms of funding. This is, you know, number of staff people we would need. This is how you could pay for it. Oftentimes that's paid for from those the landlords, people that own the rental properties. It's kind of they pay an additional assessment to the city so that the city can perform those. So those are things you'd look into. And,
you know, my concern, Derek, on that is there's already safeguards built into the statutes. The right. Landlords are required to have habitable dwelling units.
Right.
And then habitability is clearly defined: adequate water, sewage, heating, garbage disposal, roof. All of those issues are addressed already in the state statutes. Mm-hmm. There are remedies available in the statutes that are already in place for tenants who feel that the landlord is not fulfilling their obligations under the law.
Yeah, legal remedies, right? You're referring
well,
to.
There's remedies about withholding rent, about,
right.
There's all kinds of remedies, well, several different remedies available, not all kinds, but
right.
There are several remedies available. And it just seems, you know, if you're going to You know, I think I advocated against this when we had the sessions.
Yeah.
Regarding this proposal here. If you're going to add another layer here, then somebody has to fund it. If you're going to fund it, you're going to look to the landlords. If you look to the landlords to fund it, they're going to recoup that by increasing rents, you know. I think you're creating, you know, you're looking for an answer to a problem that I frankly don't see is really a pressing need as compared to, you know, finding housing for folks.
Well, I hear what you're saying. I would just emphasize this. M is not a commitment to do it. M is a commitment to research what would be involved in doing it so that policymakers can weigh whether or not they want to. And a number of the factors you bring up, Braulio, are factors they would need to weigh, that would need to be part of that. Is not, you know, not only what is it, you know, what's the feasibility of standing up the program, but how does that program then relate to other processes and remedies that are in place for tenants? We certainly heard through public outreach that this is an important issue. And so taking the step to assess its feasibility is a reasonable and prudent step. Now, whether or not that commits, you know, at the end of the day, policymakers want to take that next step and stand up the program, I think that would be a big lift. I'm not sure that there's political interest in doing that. But, you know, seeing what is involved and how that would relate to these other programs, now that's a reasonable thing to do. And then, you know, policymakers can choose where they want to go.
Would part of that be an assessment of existing rental housing? Just go around and take a look, see what's there and what kind of conditions?
I don't know that. We'll have to put some thought to that. I mean, part of this is, that in of itself could be a huge time and resource step. But a cursory one, just to look at the general, you know, at a data perspective, these say we have 1,200 multifamily units and 800 of them were built prior to 1970. And, you know, we can do some of that kind of just to give you the age of your rental stock.
The census usually tells
you. I mean, there's some basic things like that, but actually driving and going into that, that's a huge lift at that point when you're going into all of them.
I've had to do that at a different jurisdiction that I worked for before.
Well,
up and down the alley.
But that doesn't even get into your single family, which is a harder one to get a hold of.
Is rental housing subject to fire department inspections periodic?
Your larger multifamily, the fire department would be on that, because multifamily, you know, is going to have your egress issues, your centralized fire alarm systems in many cases, your sprinkler systems. So yes, they'll look at the wind havens, the surf views, and the larger stuff. Even some of the smaller multifamily, they'll be looking at, because that gets into the commercial. What they won't be looking at is they don't get into your one and two family. They don't even know where those exist, frankly.
You know, my final comment on this issue of of rental issues is that the legislature right now is still considering a package of bills that will address. Well, there's bills to address. Rent control, limiting the amount of an increase that a landlord can impose. There's bills pending that would modify the eviction process and make it more difficult for a landlord to recover their property. So I'm just wondering if some of these issues aren't really being considered at the state level. And
well, that's a reasonable thing, Braulio, to pass on to the council as part of your comments, is say just be cognizant of what may be coming through the legislature as you look at these issues, because what's coming through the legislature now or even in 24 or 25, you know, it could significantly influence how the city wants to respond to certain issues, and not just this one. I mean, you can look at the development code barriers. Right now I'm looking at a bill, 3414, has another hearing tomorrow. It's a governor's bill, which is thou shalt grant developers, you know, variances to whatever they want, except for this list of stuff. You know, I mean, okay, so there goes your off-street parking. There goes your, go down the list. So what the legislature does could significantly influence this on a number of fronts. I hear you. I mean,
it's a good point, though.
Another bill that's eliminating local control in ports. Ports could,
yep.
Yeah, they could not enforce local ordinances. Primarily having to do with big development. It all started with that Jordan Cove thing.
Yeah, that one's starting to get, that one's getting fixed, I believe. I haven't seen whether or not their amendments hit yet or not, but they're curtailing that back significantly.
Well, I hope so, because that would just be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the original version of that one basically said if you have a deep water port facility that you're not subject to, you can do any kind of upland or in-water development and not be subject to land use regulations. Whereas something more narrowly tailored, like you don't have to take a goal exception every time you want to do maintenance dredging for your facility. Well, I think people can get behind stuff like that, but this wholesale, you know, you don't have to comply with land use regulations at all. That's the kind of stuff that's getting kicked. There's a whole lot more in the way of legislation right now that is exempting things from land use stuff than ever has in the past. It seems like this is the target for, you know, land use stuff must be holding back housing. Well, land use stuff in some jurisdictions probably does, but that's not generally the case. Generally the case, you know, lack of available land, developable land, infrastructure costs, labor and material costs, those are much bigger drivers. But they're tougher things for the legislature to tackle.
Right. And there isn't lobbyists.
Yes.
Like there is for things like that one I mentioned, which is strictly only as a result of commercial interest trying to get that passed so that they can do stuff that would not normally be allowed under local regulations.
So those are the 13. Barlow, I heard some concerns about M doubling up on existing processes and be cognizant of what might be coming down the pipe from the legislature. Those are the two big themes I got from you on that one, with concerns about.
Derek, could I also suggest that for M, many jurisdictions, rather than beefing up the code enforcement side, provide better advocacy or access to advocacy for tenants. Many tenants know there's a problem, want it addressed, but are challenged with how best to advocate for their needs, whether it be legal remedies or otherwise. Sometimes it's a matchmaking between tenants and resources that can help them force a landlord to do the right thing. Sometimes that's a lot less expensive than a maintenance code team.
I think during the public hearing, or the community hearing, a lady mentioned that. Didn't she mention about landlord-tenant training? Were there against the wall. She was a real estate agent. But there's the people back here.
Well, what I heard actually was some concerns with, I think it's more in line with kind of what might be in line with kind of where you're going to, Braulio, is that there are some concerns from existing property owners who own multifamily property that the rules are getting such that they're not really interested in continuing to own multifamily property.
Yes.
Because they're having to be so accommodating to tenants, including those that are no longer paying their rent, for example, that it just is not something that's attractive to them any longer as an investment and as something that they want to do in terms of income producing, that they want to get out of the multifamily properties and managing those properties.
COVID didn't help either.
So, and I've heard plenty of that too in terms of what's you know, yeah, I understand.
Yeah, that disincentive is what I was referring to with them. Is more of those things you do, the fewer landlords are going to be willing to participate, and they may just say, screw it, or raise the rent dramatically.
Okay. Any other thoughts generally on these? Did you want me to pass along to the council? what I can do is I'll just summarize what you're saying here in the staff report and say, hey, look, share it with, because you guys have been engaged in this process all the way through at this point.
I'm curious. Oh, are we done with that topic?
Yeah, unless anybody else has anything else.
Okay. We have another topic.
Is that the end?
Of we have one more agenda item after this.
One more to okay. do.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could somebody put a motion forward to initiate the legislative amendments for the multifamily commercial trash enclosure closure standards?
No, 4B.
Aren't we going to discuss this again at our next work session?
We were, but we, because
you're just initiating the legislative process, yeah, so I can get everything. Okay.
So we can get it.
I'll move that we initiate the legislative amendments for the multifamily commercial trap enclosures as set forth earlier today. And let me find the number that we were working
on. So we don't need a motion for 4B? No? Okay. No. Set off.
I'll second.
Yeah, okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Any opposed? Don't hear any. So staff can initiate the legislative amendment. Okay, that brings us up to public hearings, new business, and unfinished business. Kind of a potpourri of stuff.
Yeah, I didn't have anything else on the agenda.
I had a question about that appeal.
Yes.
I understand it's very limited. It's limited to the existing record.
Right.
And that there won't be any applicant's testimony or opponent's testimony or anything like that.
No, the way the code works is the appellant will have their opportunity to make their case on the record.
Okay.
Staff will provide a staff report, and then the council will deliberate. Okay. That's how
so you're
going
to you're going to present the staff report.
Well, yeah. What you
as,
yeah, basically, I'll be presenting. This is the nature of the Planning Commission decision, which they have. Council's had a chance to review it. Read it, they understand. So I'll say this is, I'll go through what that is, what the rationale was there. Then I'll go through, this was on this one particular issue. Here were the other things that were in play, the conditional use criteria. So they have full context of what the whole package of the permit was, package. And then, that's my role to go through that. Now, if there's any issues in the support brief, by the way, that the applicant has prepared, which was just posted, because they had 7 days to prepare their support brief.
Oh.
7 days from when the record was made available to them.
Posted where?
It should be on the website. It was posted today. It came in on Friday, at the end of the day on Friday, which was their deadline.
It goes on May 15th?
Yeah, May 15th is when the council takes this up. So that's coming up. But they had 7 days to prepare a support brief, which is, their argument relative to what was in the record. And so you want to take a look at that. You'll see their argument, and their arguments, say, look at page blank or exhibit blank or, so on and so forth. If there's any issue in that our city attorney believes is something the council can't consider, he will point that out.
Yeah.
This is on the record only. So there's no new evidence that's permitted. The appellant can't introduce it. Like, nobody can introduce it.
All right, and your staff report, this is quite specific. Are you going to present the rationale or a rationale for why we could have approved that based on the buildings that aren't there anymore? If those buildings were still in existence, they would have gotten this allowance. Therefore, they would have met the criteria. Are you going to go through that?
That's the appellant. That's they're the ones. What I'm going to go through is you guys. The Planning Commission made a decision to not grant the adjustment for parking. And this is what the rationale was for that. And because the adjustment for parking was denied, the balance of the permit stuff went down too. Because you didn't move beyond that. I mean, that's right. That was how the decision was structured. Then I'm going to move on and talk about here's what those other standards were. Because it's possible the council doesn't agree with you. They need to at least understand what everything else was. Or they could say, we don't agree with the Planning Commission on this point.
but we end up turning around and denying it on another point. I mean, they need to have the full context of what the entire permit package is.
Could we get a copy of your draft staff report?
You'll get it when the council gets it. It's going to be available just like your stuff is the Thursday prior to the council meeting.
How you phrase that could go a long ways towards the council's response. Yeah. And so I think it'd be nice to at least review it to see if the
commission... Well, we have no recourse. Even if we reviewed it and violently disagreed, there's absolutely nothing right. we can do about it at this point.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be the city manager who's going to be doing more of the talking than me anyway. But they will undoubtedly turn it over to me because there's details that Spencer's not going to be comfortable trying to delve into because he just doesn't have the history.
But I think you have a strong voice, Derek. Mm-hmm. And I know this body listens to what you have to say, and I know the council also does.
I'm not advocating on this. I'm just laying out this is what the decision was. This is the reason why the commission made the decision that it did. And I'm going to stick to what's articulated in writing that's been signed off. And yes, I'll touch on stuff that's in the staff report too, but I'm not going to deviate from it. I'm just going to be, okay, this is what the reasoning was as outlined in the staff report. Planning Commission on this front disagreed. They felt this is where the parking issue needed to go. This is the finding and decision they made. Bing, done.
Just the facts.
Yeah, you can.
Just the facts, man. Just the facts, man.
This is
Dragnet. Book them.
Yeah, book them.
Really, the only ones making arguments are going to be the appellant. Okay. They're going to be the ones making arguments that you know the decision was wrong.
Yeah.
Based on their evidence
brief is
the
up
record.
There now. Their
yeah.
brief is available now.
Yeah.
Under the city council.
Same spot where the record is, at this point.
Okay.
Which is on our community development website.
Okay.
And then, yeah. And then, like I said, staff report, it'll go up on Thursday. I haven't drafted it yet, so. And I don't know that I'm going to put a whole lot into it other than because we're just attaching all of that stuff right now.
Okay. Any other comments, requests, questions? Nope, Bob's. Okay. Regular session has ended at 7:52.
Thank you, Bill.
Or 1952, if you don't like.